So as we saw last time, ordinary people like Billy Sunday could be used, and people like Parham and William Seymour, and people who were not the influential folks, and yet God did extraordinary things through them. Well, in this chapter, we're going to go on to talk about what is sometimes referred to as the fourth awakening, or ongoing revival. I want to set the stage. Faith had gone through some challenges once again, at least the faith of, in a broad sense of the church. In the 1920s, we became for the first time an urban nation. Now, we've talked about immigration and how the cities were growing and expanding, but it was in the 1920s that for the first time more people lived in the cities than lived in the country. So 51.4%. 1920s were also a time when there was a rise in the standard of living that was unmatched probably in the history of the United States, even though we've always been seen as the place of opportunity. Labor laws kept many people from experiencing. But in the 1920s, there began to be agreements between labor and management, so much so that leisure time became a reality for the first time in many people's lives. Prior to labor laws, of course, you know, you've heard the stories of the sweatshops, and you've heard the stories about the abuse that the labor that was foisted upon children. And now, all of a sudden, people were earning a living, and they had time. And so it's during the 1920s. They're called the Roaring Twenties for a reason. Entertainment began to blossom, and so people became household names like Charlie Chaplin. Became a household name because people could go to the movies, and the movie industry began to blossom during this time because people were looking for something to do. And so this was an entertaining thing. Charles Lindbergh, there were national heroes like Charles Lindbergh because his trip across the Atlantic Ocean was covered by the press, and it was a new time, and so there was this a rise in the standard of living that made people focus on fun and on finance and on progress. And there was also a contributing to the downturn in religiosity in the country through the controversy in the church. And what I have in mind there is the 1925 Scopes trial. Took place in Tennessee. John Scopes was a recent graduate of a college, and he went into the teaching profession. Now, Tennessee had a law on the books that you could not teach evolution. You had to teach creation. You could not teach evolution. Well, John Scopes broke the law, and he was brought up on charges, and there was going to be this great trial called the Scopes trial. Now, in order to make this trial go, some very, very famous people got involved. That's Clarence Darrow. Now, if you live in the United States and you didn't know anything about history, you probably know the name Clarence Darrow. He was one of the best-known lawyers of that day, and the name still resounds in history. And so he was going to be on one side of this trial of this man. He was going to defend John Scopes, defend the right to teach evolution in the schools. Well, the conservative church group gathering decided that they needed a big name too, so they got Williams Jennings Bryant, one-time presidential candidate, to be on the other side. The trial took place. It was during a hot period of the year, and there are over 2 million words written reporting on this trial. Some called it the monkey trial. In other words, would we go back to the whole idea of descending from monkeys, or do we stand on the church's view of creationism? And in the papers, it became kind of a national joke. And as a result, you know, the fundamentalist side, which was largely represented by William Jennings Bryant, came off kind of as ignoring all the scientific advances that had taken place for so many years. And so the church was seen publicly in 2 million words of reporting on it, not all of them from the other side, but seen as, you know, kind of behind the times and marginalized in society. So those kind of events had a downward trend on the spirituality in our country. Another trend was the Dust Bowl. the depression of the 1930s. We go to the 1930s and we find the depression is something anybody who lived through it will tell you story after story. My parents lived through the depression, and I heard stories from my father of going door to door to sell needles, packages of needles for a nickel apiece, and waiting in line at the Civic Auditorium in Grand Rapids, Michigan, because they were handing out oranges, and he wanted to get some oranges for his family. People working. My mother worked as a maid, doing everything in the house, from cleaning to meal preparation, as a very young teenage girl for 50 cents a day. The depression was very real. 1929, the income in this country, across the country, was $83 billion. By 1932, it was $40 billion, less than half. 1933, the unemployment ranks swelled in this country to 15 million people out of work, and soup lines became common. People leaving the cities to go out to the country and forage for food. But that became a real problem, because another force that had an impact on the life of the church was the Dust Bowl. If you've ever seen pictures of that, here's a picture of a town in the Midwest as one of the dust clouds comes through. During that time, there was little understanding about how in the world you could plow a field to keep the topsoil from blowing away. And so during those years in the middle 1930s, the winds would come up and the dust would just blow all the topsoil away. And it would come in these huge clouds. And as a result, farming was not done much in that area during that period of time. And so that whole middle western portion of the country became a kind of a barren wasteland. There was all sorts of foreclosures happening on farms because people couldn't plant a crop that would be there long enough to pay the mortgage on the house and on the farm. And so farms were foreclosed on. It was an ugly time in the history of the United States. And ugly times have a force on spirituality. They have either the impact of drawing people closer to God or more deeply dependent on Him, or it draws people away from God. And so this period of time was kind of a mixture. There were people in the 20s and 30s who were growing and deepening in their faith, but there were one who were saying, what's the use of praying to a God when life, everything we know of life, has just kind of gone away? And then, of course, during this period, there were forces described this way by Sidney Ahlstrom, whom I've quoted before as a historian. He said, adding greatly to the uneasiness of church-going Americans of all classes was the continued advance of those changes in manners and mores that had made the 1920s a nightmare for rural America. Despite the Depression, urban civilization continued to make its conquests. Jazz, dancing, feminism, and the Hollywood star system mocked the older older moral standards, both Catholic and Protestant. Hard times notwithstanding, the automobile continued to transform traditional modes of living and loving. Sabbath keeping was losing ground. So you've got the 20s and the 30s, is what he's saying. And the impact on the church or Christianity was that it was losing ground, partly because the whole society was changing. It was changing in that idea of Sabbath keeping. Now, up until this time, when most of the country lived in the country or lived in farming, agriculturally based communities, Sabbath keeping was a normal thing. People went to church in the morning and they gathered at grandma's house for the lunch in the afternoon. And they would gather and they would talk about a variety of things, but that was a time when the family kind of kept faith by keeping Sabbath. But now there were all these new things going on, and the city was the place to be. And Sabbath keeping was something that got in the way of the fun that was being had. And so the impact on the faith aspects of the country was negative. In addition to the Dust Bowl and the Depression of the 30s, there were theological controversy that was going on as well. It was during this time that Neo-Orthodoxy came into its own. The picture on the screen is of Karl Barth. He's called the best known theologian of the 20th century. A very influential he was a German theologian, but somebody who's bringing orthodoxy and social gospel and liberalism together. And he was very, very influential, as were some of his disciples, but the overall impact was that it did not renew the church. So you got 20s and 30s decline, and then the 1940s, there's war. And war changed everything. December 7, 1941, the day that will live in infamy, changed the life of America. All of a sudden, we went from a country with no standing army, really, very limited, to a nation that had to retool toward becoming a nation at war. And so people signing up, men signing up by the hundreds, thousands, to go into the army to fight against Hitler and leaving home. And then women having to go into the workplace because we're trying to produce war material. We're trying to produce tanks and jeeps and guns and ammunition, and we weren't geared up for that. So factories have to retool, but now the men are going away. So instead of the young men, young women take their place, and it goes on. And then there are the deaths that start to happen. Hardly a neighborhood that didn't have a star of some color indicating somebody who was out, who was deployed, or somebody who had been killed, or somebody who had been injured in the war. And so all of this time was a time when the church was still doing well, because those are times when people pray mightily, you know, when they recognize how scary it is for somebody you love to be out in harm's way, as we refer to it nowadays. People prayed, and prayed often. And there was a brief renewal in the church, although it wasn't a revival. And then at the end of the war, the atomic bomb brought everything into sharp relief. Everything in society all of a sudden became questioned, because now we could destroy civilization. I grew up in the 1950s, and I remember crazy stuff, because at that time, after the dropping of the atomic bomb, in watching the devastation that it could cause on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, after that, when Russia got the whole ability to produce nuclear weapons, it was the Cold War period. And wow, that was a time I remember practicing in school, getting under our desks. At the time, I didn't think of how stupid that would be during a nuclear war, that this desk was somehow going to protect me. But there was this fear in Cold War. And fears like that sometimes can create a climate in which faith can begin to grow. So, got a bunch of changes that are happening in the 40s. Women in the workforce, and then dislocation of families. After the war, suburbia starts to become a reality. People are moving to the cities again to become part of the workforce that's there, and families are no longer connected to grandma's house, and so that traditional Sabbath keeping starts to break down what had become the family unit. So that's the 40s. In the 50s, there were some changes as well. The anti-communism, Joe McCarthy. Now it's mocked when you look back at history. You find that emphasis on anti-communism and finding communists everywhere and finding communists in the government and communists in the movie industry and all of that. And it was a time of witch hunting of a sort, and was a highly negative effect on society in general, and people began at first to go along with it, but then they got sick of it. And so anti-communism had a force that began to impact our society, but because the communists were anti-God, the overall force was that it made us more interested in God. And then, of course, the Korean War in the 50s also had that impact. Again, people out in the potential of being killed at any moment, and so it impacted people's prayer life. Now, all of that stuff, the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, the 4 decades, the church is just kind of going along. It's still doing its thing, but society and the church are becoming more and more divided from each other. Would there be a revival? Now, there's some indication during these years that God continued to work in his church. Here's just some statistics about what we think were the numbers of people, percentage-wise, attending church in the United States. 1910, 43%, 43%, 20, 30, 47%, 1940, 49%, 1950, 55%. Now we're in the post-Second World War. 1956, 62%. 1960, well, we're going to get to those decades later, but 69%. 1970, 62.4%, the high percentage-wise, coming in the 1960s. But during this time, there was a sense of spiritual interest and spiritual renewal. A couple of them that are very, very public is that phrase in our Pledge of Allegiance, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. That phrase, one nation under God, was added to the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954. In 1956, In God We Trust was first put on the coinage in the United States. It still is there. Now, that had been kind of an unofficial motto for the country for a long time, but now it was official that this is our official motto, In God We Trust. Now, during that 40-year period, I've just said, just, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, there was this sense that the church is continuing, in spite of the fact that there is this divide that's happening between the church and society in general. There is the church going on, and there is a health and vitality in the church, a vibrancy in the church. But revivalism kind of goes out of existence. After Billy Sunday and some of the extremes of the revivalists of that day, you know, Billy Sunday, who made his reputation, you know, encouraging people to go to war and encourage people to stop drinking, and then you know, some of the money stuff, and all of that stuff led to a decline in revivalism, so that during these years you can hardly read anything about revivalism or revivalists. But after World War II, suddenly it starts coming back. And the main figure, the one we're going to look at next time, because he deserves a chapter all his own, because his story is unique, is Billy Graham. And next time we're going to look at his story, because it's one that continues to live out today. As I'm speaking today, he is a very old man. And yet his influence and the respect that this country has for him still lives on. He is still listed as one of the most respected people in the United States. And so he's somebody we have to get to know if we're going to understand this history of revivals, as God takes another fairly ordinary person and does something extraordinary through him.